Welcome to the Coin Podcast Network.
A family of five takes a Sunday drive and vanishes.
Well, has anybody seen or heard anything today? Try and get any kind of information. Nothing was going on.
One detective refusing to accept the official story.
It's much, much harder to substantiate accident theory than it is the foul play theory.
More than six decades later, the mystery endures, and the question remains.
This kind of thing just really didn't happen. It was always a mystery.
What happened to the Martin family?
When we find the car in the Columbia River, we will find the Martin family, and we will solve this case.
Hello, I'm Ian Costello, and welcome to this special presentation from the Coin Podcast Network. 62 years after a Portland family vanished in the Columbia River Gorge, Coin 6 News anchor Jeff Gianola and I sat down with author J.B. Fisher to talk about the case. Over the course of 9 months and several conversations with Fisher and others, Jeff and I put together this story on the Martin family, the strange circumstances surrounding their disappearance, and the mystery that remains. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy. Back here in the Coin Podcast Network studio with Coin 6 News anchor Jeff Gianola. And Jeff, the last time we talked, we were talking about a cab that was seen outside the Martin home on the morning after they vanished, but according to the official investigation, before anyone knew they were gone.
Yeah, it was a woman, a neighbor, who was up early, getting ready to go to work, and she saw the taxi idling there. She even had to have the taxi move so she could get by with her own car.
It looked like it had been there for quite a while.
Yeah, according to what she told police, it had been idling there for a while, like it was waiting for someone.
That's just the latest in a long line of things that Detective Graven is uncovering in this case that, when you take them all into consideration, Jeff, they really don't jive with the official story here.
Yeah, and we're going to get into all of those puzzling pieces here in part three. But safe to say, Ian, things like the bloody and battered gun we heard about and the taxi you mentioned at the end of part two, Walter Graven can't shake this idea that the Martins had gone into the gorge that Sunday to meet someone and were met with foul play.
And with that, let's begin part three.
Part 3, Echoes Through Time. The Martins told everyone they were taking a Sunday drive up the Columbia River Gorge to collect Christmas greenery. They left their home between 1 and 2 in the afternoon on December 7, 1958. It would be the last time neighbors would ever see the Martin family again. Ken and Barbara and their three daughters, Virginia, Sue, and Barbie. At 7:20 a.m. the next morning, a neighbor sees a taxi idling in front of the Martin home.
Well, it sat there for a while, and apparently the driver slumped down in the seat as if to not be seen.
J.B. Fisher has written a book on the Martin mystery called Echo of Distant Water.
At one point, neighbor had to ask him to move because Ken Martin's truck was on the other side of the road and there wasn't enough room for her to get by. And he was there for probably about a half hour or so.
And it looked like he was waiting for someone who was inside the Martin home.
Yeah, he was right in front of the house and just idling there.
Was there any sign of a break-in in the house?
No, there wasn't. There was no broken lock, no broken windows, anything like that.
And whoever was in the house had gone through Ken Martin's desk. There were papers missing, including some ledger books. And JB, do we know what ledgers or papers specifically were missing?
Well, it's hard to say for sure, Jeff. You know, there's some thought, apparently, that the ledger books had something to do with some information that perhaps someone didn't want discovered, and also some financial records that were missing. Could imagine someone was looking into those for information that might benefit them.
But this eyewitness account of the taxi didn't surface until 6 months after the Martins vanished. How could such an important piece of information go unnoticed for so long?
So that's a really interesting piece of this, Jeff. The neighbor had actually reported seeing the taxi cab to Charlotte Dorsey, to Ken's sister. The expectation was that Charlotte Dorsey was going to notify the police. So in June of 59, 6 months later, when this comes out, there's still a question, did Charlotte Dorsey notify police? And if not, why not?
Maybe it was grief, maybe it was shock, a miscommunication. We don't know. But we do know the report about the taxi came in too late to be of any help.
The police report basically specifies that the witness believed it was a black and white cab, which might very well link it to radio cab. And apparently they checked. They did a search of area cabs and drivers and couldn't find any link.
Older son Don Martin was living back east. He hadn't bothered to come back home when his family went missing. Detective Graven considered Don a person of interest in the case, and about the same time the delayed police report on the taxi came out, Don finally returned to Portland to settle the family estate. And he would meet Detective Graven face to face.
When he came home in June of 1959 and talked with the detective, that's apparently when he learned that these papers had been missing from his father's desk. He actually was the one who discovered it and was very shocked and upset by it.
According to Detective Graven's notes on the meeting, Don said the following, quote, "I know of no one who would murder my folks or no reason for it, but I don't see how it could have been an accident." Strong words. Maybe Don wasn't directly involved in his family's disappearance, but did he know someone who could have been? There was no sign of a break-in at the Martin house. Could the intruder have been a friend of the family or someone who knew the Martins? Someone with a key. More on that in a moment. Let's recap what we know about the search for the Martins and what Detective Graven was uncovering. Item 1. The Martins left their home that Sunday. They told neighbors they were on their way to the Columbia River Gorge. Item 2. A gas station receipt places them at Cascade Locks later that same afternoon. Although he has no hard evidence, the sheriff there has determined the Martins accidentally drove into the river at the locks. Case closed. Item 3. Working on his own, Detective Graven places the Martin family 19 miles east of Cascade Locks later in the day, eating at a cafe in Hood River. And he also discovers two ex-cons were seen in the cafe at that same time. A couple reports seeing the Martin's car driving at a high rate of speed back to Cascade Locks. They see the car pulled over with two men, possibly the ex-cons, standing next to it. Item 4. Detective Graven finds tire tracks and paint scrapings exactly matching the Martin car on a rocky cliff above the Columbia River in the Dalles, a town east of both Cascade Locks and Hood River. Item 5. A bloody gun is found near Cascade Locks in the area where the ex-cons had abandoned a stolen car. Detective Graven traces that weapon. It's the same gun stolen by older son Don Martin a few years earlier and never recovered. Item 6. In May, 5 months after the Martins went missing, a barge working near the cliff in the Dalles hooked something heavy, and the bodies of Sue and Virginia Martin are found downriver. An autopsy technician who took pictures of the bodies thought both girls had bullet holes through their skulls. The medical examiner ruled otherwise. Detective Graben now believes someone had contacted the Martins, asking them to meet them that Sunday. During that encounter, the family was killed. The car and bodies dumped over the cliff at the Dalles. Were the ex-cons hired to harm the family? What would be a motive? Detective Graben was convinced the Martins were the victims of foul play, but his superiors and other investigators dismissed his findings. They clung to the theory that the Martins accidentally drove into the river at Cascade Locks. JB, let's back up here. Could this have been as simple as a tragic accident?
Well, you know, I mean, the reality is we just don't know for sure. But honestly, Jeff, it's much, much harder to substantiate accident theory than it is the foul play theory. There are many more pieces that connect dots with foul play, the things we've been talking about, the gun, the car, the ex-cons, all these things. Whereas when you talk about the accident, there's really not much at all. I've spoken with people at Cascade Locks, old timers there, and they basically laughed at the idea that a car drove into the lock.
How did the media at the time cover the search and the investigation?
There were two newspapers in Portland during this time, the Oregonian and the Oregon Journal. And the coverage, as you can imagine in a case like this, you know, right around Christmas time, quintessential 50s family, the dad playing Santa, all of this was kind of story that people just couldn't look away from.
One of the newspaper reporters covering the Martin case was a woman named Ann Sullivan.
So Ann Sullivan had been a reporter at the city desk through the 1940s. She got on the paper during World War II when most male reporters were off in the war. She was actually the first female journalist in Oregon at the city desk at the Oregonian.
When the police report on the taxi and possible person inside the Martin home came to light, Ann Sullivan reported on it. But JB, she also alerted her editor on something she wasn't including in her story, possibly because of legal reasons.
When she was writing about this case, she left a little footnote saying, basically, we can't talk about a friend of the family who had a key to the house.
We know by reading Detective Graven's notes, Don had a friend named Wayne.
Wayne had been close with Don in the mid-50s when Don was working at Meyer and Frank.
Not only friends, Wayne had been Don's roommate when Don had stolen the gun from the Meyer and Frank department store where he was working at the time. During his interview with Detective Graben, Don told him, quote, while he liked nice things, Wayne liked guns. And JB, Wayne was also friendly with the Martin family.
He had become a park director at Rose City Park, right around the corner from the Martins, in about 1958. He actually had done some parades, some activities with the girls at the park there that summer before they disappeared.
Reporter Ann Sullivan had also told her editor the unnamed friend of the family who had the key lived in Cascade Locks. And JB, where was Wayne living and working when the Martins disappeared?
So he was a coach at Cascade Locks High School. In Cascade Locks, he was a basketball coach and also had done some coaching on the football team. He was working there at that time.
We know Detective Graben met with Wayne early on in his investigation. But at the time, his questions centered on Wayne's relationship with Don. But as he kept putting the pieces together, Detective Graben was rethinking his suspicions about Don Martin. One sentence in his notebook says the following, quote, it had to be planned out by a name is blacked out. It goes on to say, no one else with a motive. Using computer photo enhancement, JB, you discovered the name blacked out reads
Donald.
We don't know at what point in his investigation Detective Graven covered up Don's name. So, JB, the question we have to ask is, what would be the possible motive to harm the Martin family?
One of the things that was always looked into pretty heavily at the time of the investigation was any kind of association that Ken Martin might have with, you know, shady business dealings or anything like that. All of that was ruled out.
As for the Martin estate, it was pretty modest. There was some life insurance that Don received, but not a significant amount. Greg Graven is police chief of Yamhill, Oregon, and the grandson of Detective Graven. Greg, your grandfather had another theory when it came to motive.
My grandfather's theory was that there was some type of a circumstance that motivated the Martin family to go over to Hood River and then the Dalles. He doesn't feel that that was them doing that on their own. There was some other type of influence. Possibly could have been something having to do with Barbie.
A circumstance motivating them to meet someone that Sunday. 14-year-old Barbie was the oldest Martin girl. In reading Detective Graven's notes, he questions if someone the family knew may have had a connection or relationship with Barbie. Was there an issue that needed to be resolved or talked about? We know the name Wayne continues to show up in Detective Graven's notes, but Graven was under mounting pressure to stop his investigation. Wayne was never questioned again by Detective Graven. But 50 years after the Martins went missing, I met Wayne face to face. While producing my 2008 documentary on the Martins, I had seen Wayne's name in Detective Graven's case file, but wasn't able to find him. Was he even still alive? Immediately after the story aired, I got a lengthy email from Wayne recounting his connection to the Martins and their disappearance. I contacted him, asked if he could shed light on what he knew. In an interview without cameras, Wayne told me he knew the family intimately. He seemed nervous, yet talkative. As for the Sunday the family disappeared, Wayne said, if I had known they were in Cascade Locks, I would have wanted to see them, but that he didn't realize they were there. When I asked about what could have happened to the Martin family, Wayne said this, quote, I'm just fabricating this, but maybe you hire someone to kill the family. So they say $5,000 to kill the family. So give me the five. An odd thing to say. JB, you've gone over my transcripts of that interview. What were your impressions?
It sounds especially mysterious. For instance, his claim that he knew the whole family intimately, he called it. He talks about how when the family was in Cascade Locks, he didn't realize it. He says something like, they would have wanted to see me that day. And if I had known they were there, I would have wanted to see them. There are just some things in the interview that suggest that this was a important story for him in ways maybe more than just simply as a friend.
In the early 1960s, just a few years after the Martins went missing, Wayne moved to Germany, where he remained for the next 30 years. He later returned to Oregon, and by that time, any memories or interest in the case, any new clues, like the Martins themselves, had vanished. The Martins had gone missing in December 1958. And now 1959 was coming to an end, and so was Detective Graven's investigation into the case. Not by his choice. He was told to stop following his leads, to button up the case. Officially, he followed orders. But what happened to the Martins haunted him for the rest of his life. And Greg, he never gave up trying to solve this case.
So my grandfather investigated this case throughout the remainder of his career as a detective, which would have been about 10 years from 1958 till he retired nearing 1968. During his career as a detective, on his own, conducted the investigation. He would take my father out and my aunts out, and they would go to the Columbia River in the area, and he would speak with them, and they were involved.
Gloria Graven is the daughter of Walter Graven, and she has kept all of her father's original notes and case files stored in boxes. I asked her about her father's obsession with this case.
It wasn't just this case. When he worked on murder cases, he always was obsessed with them. He was a good detective, and he wanted them solved. He just felt like he wasn't doing his job if he didn't solve the case. And this was one of them that didn't get solved. And maybe the only murder case he worked on that didn't get solved. And so that's why it was just an obsession with him. And he would let it go for a while, but then it was always on his mind.
As you read through Detective Graven's notes on the Martin case, there are words of encouragement he seems to be writing to himself. One entry reads, "Even though I can get no cooperation from anyone, there is no murder that can't be solved." As for the eldest son, Don Martin, the only family member left, he never came back to live in Portland. JB, what do we know about Don's life?
Yeah, so Don was career Navy. He married another member of the Navy, and they had four children, three daughters and a son. They lived in Hawaii on the island of Oahu for most of his later life. That's where he raised the kids, and his kids still live there today.
In October of 2004, Don Martin died. A few years after his death, while working on my documentary, I reached out to Don's daughter, Sarah. She agreed to meet me at her home in Hawaii. But when I arrived, she called in tears, saying her older sister told her, "There are some things in this family we don't talk about." And JB, that's the real tragedy of this. Don apparently never mentioned his parents or his sisters to his children. While working on your book a few years ago, you reached out to Don's children. It had been 10 years since I contacted Sarah, and Don's children were much more receptive to talk now. You met them in Hawaii with pictures and information about their past.
It was so moving to sit there and look at them with them because, you know, I suddenly realized I know more about the stuff than they do. So I was pointing out, oh, that's so-and-so, and that's over at this other house over in the Hollywood District. And this is when Barbara was in the Rose Festival as a kid. And it was clear, you know, I have no doubt that Don's kids were being honest with me, that they just don't know about any of this, that they had grandparents and aunts who disappeared until late in his life.
And JB, Sarah wanted to apologize to me for canceling her interview a few years earlier.
She said, "Please explain to Jeff that we're good people. We do care. We just didn't know how or where to start or who to trust. We grew up with zero knowledge."
In 2019, Sarah died of cancer. JB, why do you think Don never told his children about his parents and sisters?
You know, honestly, Jeff, I think that this kind of a trauma, you know, on one level, it's just something that he was protecting his own family from having to go there. While I was there, you know, I was sharing with them, oh, Ken used to dress up as Santa Claus and put out these candy canes. And they said, oh, our dad did that too. It was gingerbread man, it wasn't candy cane. And he had these traditions. He loved Christmas and he would do all this. on one level, it might just be he is basically trying to keep them in a protected bubble from all of that.
JB, now a direct question. Do you think Don Martin was somehow involved in his family's disappearance?
You know, I've thought about this a lot, Jeff, and I really think that this was something that was out of his control, that he was watching from afar, that it was something that he knew about and had connection to, but it wasn't something that he ultimately was playing a direct role in. And I think that's part of the explanation for why he stayed away from Portland and why he didn't tell his own family. I think this was something that spiraled. I mean, we know that there is evidence that he had hard feelings about his family and that there was a grudge, but there's also a lot here in the record that suggests that that was not the motive.
In February of 1988, Detective Walter Graven died. But a few months before he passed away, he made one last trip. He had retired as a Multnomah County detective, but his bosses had ignored his work on the Martin case. In one last act of determination, Detective Graven carefully compiled all of his notes and files on the Martins and packed them in his car. And Greg, what your grandfather did was highly unusual. He went to the place where he was sure the mystery of the Martin family would be solved someday.
He took all of those documents, compiled them together, and he gave that case file to the Dallas Police Department with the request for them to solve this case.
Detective Graven came to see me in 1987.
Jay Waterbury is the former police chief of the Dalles.
I took the material he gave me, and in my years here, I've always given it to new investigators just to look at it.
Chief Waterbury is now retired, along with one of his detectives, Dan Portwood. Dan grew up with 10-year-old Sue Martin. They went to the same school. Even after retiring from the Dallas Police Department, Dan still takes his boat out on the water looking for answers at the site where Detective Graven believed the Martins and their car were pushed into the river.
I would just like to see it resolved. I knew Susan. She was a friend. I'd like to know what happened. I think it would be kind of nice if a case could still be made on it.
To this day, the Dallas Police Department maintains the Martin case as an open investigation.
My name's Scott Holbert. I am a scuba diver who lives out in White Salmon, Washington.
Scott Holbert has been diving for almost 40 years. He's a member of a sheriff's dive team and is highly trained to do technical diving in dangerous places.
So this is a type of diving where we're using, you're going down with five scuba tanks and you're staying for, an hour and a half, and it's taking you 45 minutes to do decompression stops up from the bottom.
Based on my reporting and J.B. Fisher's book on the Martin case, Scott has now immersed himself in solving this mystery on his own using high-tech diving equipment. Scott has been searching the Columbia River near the Dalles, hoping to find any evidence of the Martins in their car. And Scott, the conditions you're diving in sound pretty scary.
There's these cliffs that go from 30 feet down to 50, then from 50 down to 70, and the river goes all the way down to 200 feet. The visibility is terrible. Sometimes it's zero. Literally, you can't see your own dive computer, even if you have it right up against your face, and it's pitch black.
Over his career, Scott has located dozens of vehicles and bodies in the water, and he's determined one day to find the Martin's car.
If the car is there, I have no doubt we can find it someday.
It's been more than six decades since the Martins left their home on that Sunday afternoon, never to return. Maybe some mysteries are meant to stay that way. Mysteries never to be solved. Detective Walter Graven didn't believe that. He carefully sorted and compiled all of his notes and files on the Martin case, giving them to people he trusted, in hopes his work would guide and lead others to the answer someday. On the last page of his notebook, Detective Graven wrote one final entry. Greg, would you read what your grandfather wrote?
When we find the car in the Columbia River, in the Dalles, we will find the Martin family and we will solve this case. Grandpa is the last voice for the Martin family. And he wants to be that last voice, even still.
Jeff, here we are at the end of our long journey. I know I was really rooting for Detective Graven to solve this case. And from his grandson, Greg, you can hear the personal disappointment that Detective Graven wasn't able to put all of the pieces together before he died.
He never let this case go, Ian, even after he retired. And you heard his grandson, Greg, and his daughter, Gloria, talk about he would visit the site at the Dalles and replay all the clues in evidence in his mind. He would take his family there, even the years after he retired. This absolutely haunted him.
On the plus side, he left enough behind for other detectives and writers like JB and news people like you and I to keep tracking down this case.
Yeah, he left copies of all his notes and files with the Dalles Police Department, as we mentioned, because he trusted that those documents would be in good hands. And over the years, when they've had time, retired Police Chief Jay Waterbury and Detective Dan Portwood would look into this case. And I think in how ironic that Dan Portwood, who had grown up with Sue Martin, would one day be a detective in the Dalles, looking into her disappearance. I mean, it's just another strange coincidence in this mystery.
We heard about it toward the end of part three. Let's talk a little bit about the dives and the ongoing effort to find the Martin's car.
So because of my reports over the years on this case and JB's book, diver Scott Holbert, Ian, has really taken a keen interest in this case, and he's trying to find the Martin car. But this river really is a challenge for divers, even expert divers like Scott. However, he has already ruled out some parts of the river that he's already searched, and he thinks if the car is there, he will find it. He's found some interesting things already, including a car part that dates back to a 1950s car. We had a Ford expert look at it, but we just couldn't determine where it came from. He found a license plate in that area from the 1950s, not the Martin's license plate. But the interesting thing is, it was in great condition. You could read the numbers. So no one really knows if we find that car, will we find skeletal remains? Will there be any evidence to suggest that they met with foul play? Well, what the condition of the car will be like? Those are really big ifs, because the bottom line is, this case has no way of being solved unless you can find a car or skeletal remains.
Of course, Coin 6 News and the Coin Podcast Network will be right there following any new developments in this case, especially the search for the car. And Jeff, you heard Greg Graven say it at the end of part three, when we find the car, we will solve this mystery.
Yeah, and that's it. That's a big if, when they find the car.
You think they're going to?
I hope that they do, but maybe this is just a mystery that'll never be solved.
Well, that's the end of our special Coin Podcast Network presentation of what happened to the Martin family. But the story isn't over. You can find a wealth of extra material, like pictures of the family and the investigation, and Jeff, your 2008 documentary on the Martin family, right now on coin.com.
And be sure to check out our extended conversation with J.B. Fisher about the case, which will be available very soon on the Coin Podcast Network. Now, it's a fascinating look at the work we put into this project, and some of the theories we couldn't get into during the podcast.
Thank you very much, Jeff. This has been very enlightening and fun, and although a bit of a punch in the gut, I'm very glad to have gone along on this journey with you.
Thank you, Ian.
What Happened to the Martin Family was written and hosted by Jeff Gianola. Major research for this podcast was provided by Jeff Gianola and author J.B. Fisher. What Happened to the Martin Family was produced and edited by Ian Costello. Additional editing and archive research was provided by Mike Moore, Bethany Austin, and Caitlin Flanagan. Music and sound effects for What Happened to the Martin Family were provided by FirstCom. Additional audio engineering provided by Levon Fuentes and Rick Crochet. Promotions and social media for What Happened to the Martin Family were provided by Shuli Wasserstrom and Melinda Carlson-Smith. Additional special thanks to Greg Graven and the entire Graven family, Kate Durio, Tom Keeler, Rich Kurz, Rick Brown, Mark Bendinelli, Tim Steele, Melanie Costello, author J.B. Fisher, whose book Echo of Distant Water provided a large amount of source material for this story, and of course, Detective Walter Graven, without whom the memory of the Martin family would have been washed away in the waters of the Columbia River more than 60 years ago. What Happened to the Martin Family is copyright 2020 by the Nexstar Media Group. All rights reserved. Thank you.